Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. You know, it's always a great day when Patty Nagai comes by the studio to talk with us. And today we're going to be talking about fall gardening with her. She thinks fall gardening is the best time of the year to garden, and looking forward to talking with her. And she's on our way. Be up in the studio in just a minute. Gives me a chance to let you know what's going on Monday's program. We've been traveling around the state quite a bit. You know, this last week we were at the Beaver Creek Creek Reserve up near Eau Claire. Had a wonderful time there talking with folks. Earlier in the summer, we were in Door County and hosted a show from there. And before that, we were in Paoli, we were also in Bayfield. So lots of trips, and we've got a couple more planned, including the one on Monday, where we will be broadcasting from Plover, from the Food and Farm Exploration Center in Plover. Have you ever been there? It's the educational facility. It opened up just last year, so perhaps you haven't had time to get over there. But you can see it from Interstate 39 because the world's largest potato masher it stands outside the entrance. And so we're going to be talking with some folks from the Food and Farm Exploration Center. Dick Pavelski is one of them. He's the center's founder and president. So we'll talk with Dick, and we'll also talk with Kathleen O'Leary. She's the transition and culture strategist for the center. And Bob Kobish is director of educational programming there. So we're looking forward to being there at the Expo Center. Exploration Center. It's not exposition, it's exploration, and we'll talk with them on Monday. And at noon, Tony Schumacher, who is a Wausau-based meteorologist, more than 30-year career, and normally we would have our weather guys, but since we are in the Plover area, we've asked Tony Schumacher to join in, and I'm really looking forward to talking with Tony about his career. He's the owner of Great Lakes Weather Service. He's a longtime meteorologist for WAOW-TV in Wausau. Has a 31-year career and has covered the biggest weather events in our state, and he's going to maybe do a little reminiscing about some of the challenges covering the weather events, those tornadoes and those heat waves and that polar vortex that we have. So it's going to be a lot of fun talking with him about weather forecasting from 31 years ago all the way up to right today. So that's going to be our Monday show, and really looking forward to that. Next week, Patricia McConnell's going to be back with us, and also the author of a new book, and I'm trying to draw up my memory of the title of the book, but it has to do with dog or canine intelligence. And the author, along with Patricia McConnell, will be with us to talk about canine intelligence, and then we're going to be taking a look at the UW Vet School has a cardio unit for animals, and we're going to be talking about that with our guest. Jennifer Holland is the author of Dog Smart. That's the title of that book. It's an interview, and she did. She works, her office is at National Geographic, and she's written a number of books, but her latest book, Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence, out just this month. Can't wait for you to hear about it, and she'll be talking about her research and all the work that goes on, and how smart your dog might be. Your dog's probably pretty darn smart if you have one. So those are some of the things. And Patty you know, this is the time of year at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I'm betting it's also the time at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point and all of our UW campuses when students return. And when students return to their respective cities, things get a little messy, and there are lots and lots of cars. There are lots and lots of moving vans, and there's a lot of traffic. And Patty, I think, has run into some of that traffic, but I know she's trying to find a place to park, or maybe she's found a place to park now, and she's on her way to the studio. I think Jill Nadeau even said she'd go and meet her right at the elevator and whisk her up here to talk with you. I know she wants to talk about what's going on the end of August in the garden. What can we do now? We can talk about dividing perennials. I know she's going to want to talk about that because it's not a bad time to be doing that. We'll take a look at pruning at this time of the year. We'll talk about winter coming. But you're harvesting a lot of food at this time. I hope you are. But there is still time to plant a whole lot more. And there are some really good advantages to, you know, cleaning out those areas of the garden. You want to, you know, want to really clean them out well, and then turning around and maybe putting in some plants. But you could even put some seeds. I mean, there are a lot of seeds, vegetable seeds that you could be putting in, or even flower seeds right about now that will give you a lot of enjoyment yet into the fall. So, and I know she also likes to talk about extending that gardening season, you know, the cold weather. It's probably going to come sooner or later. It'll come. But what should we be doing to get the gardens ready for that cold weather? And I know she works out of a greenhouse, Patty does. She works at the Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls. She retired from horticulture, UW Extension, as a horticulture educator, and didn't want to just put her feet up on the couch, and instead said, I think I want to go to work a little bit more. And Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls is close to where she lives, and I know that she's found a whole lot of fun, actually. Probably makes a little money, too, on the side. But she's found a whole lot of fun working at the Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls. So, actually, we'll take a look at what's going on at the Shady Lane Greenhouse at this time of the year. We'll also take a look, and they'll have some information on the plants that are good fall bloomers. We always get questions about overwintering those beautiful mum plants. And so there's a lot to cover with her. And I just got word that she's here. She's probably on her way up the elevator as we speak. And so I'll give you a chance to join in right now. Maybe you're excited about those changing seasons. What questions do you have about gardening at this time of the year? You can join in with your questions. And an easy way to do it is to give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And here she comes into the studio right now as we speak. Patty and the guy. Patty, put on your headphones. Let's get you. Can you hear anything?
Maybe.
I'm hearing you.
Okay, that's what's important. My headphones aren't.
Oh, well, we'll get that fixed for you in just a second. Maybe it's about...
Oh, they just need a little volume. Oh, perfect. That's good. Thank you.
So how are you?
I'm so happy to be here. I just, you know, coming out of Milwaukee was crazy. Yeah. I have traffic, well, construction. And then I get to Madison, I think, oh, yay, I'm almost there. And then I was telling Jill, I sat through four stoplights at State Street because...
Yeah, the traffic.
There was a fire truck blocking the lane.
Oh.
So that's important.
Yeah.
And construction, as usual.
And the students are starting to come back.
Yeah, so. I saw a lot of young people.
Yeah, so, well, tell you what, you're here and that's great.
I am. I'm ready to talk plants.
Why do you think, you've said fall may be the best time to garden?
Absolutely. And, you know, this is known... This is more popular in other countries than it is here in the United States.
Do we get tired of it? Is that it?
Well, I think I do hear that a lot from even the most avid gardeners, that when they start getting into September, it's like, okay, I'm just ready for everything to die. I just want to clean out everything. I want the snow to come. You know, let's not rush things, though, please. But in other countries, fall is like a premier time. This is when the garden centers in, you know, other, like New Zealand.
Oh.
And, of course, this is not fall in New Zealand.
Right.
Fall in New Zealand is, you know, April. But
Europe?
But their fall, Europe, Germany... All of those places, these autumn months are when their garden centers are really revved up.
So what are they revved up with?
Well, you know, here it's just bulbs. You know, you're supposed to just plant bulbs in the fall. But honestly, fall is the best time to plant a lot of things. We could talk about fall vegetables all day because, of course, you know, I'm a vegetable girl. But also perennials, trees, and shrubs, because fall... has two fabulous things going for it. The soil is really warm, and the soil will stay warm for a long time, which means that the root systems in those plants have a great opportunity to get fully developed.
Yeah.
Not just start growing.
Grow.
We're talking about an amazing amount of root growth in the fall because the soil is so warm. And then typically, we have decent rainfall here, you know, in the fall, so they get good moisture, too. The air temperature and the shortening of days, which, of course, is also part of our fall, helps the plants with their root development as well, because it's a signal to start preparing for winter.
Yeah.
And, of course, that signal includes shuffling all of those stored carbohydrates right back down into the roots and starting that senescing process, which leads to, you know, above-ground dieback in perennials and, of course, the dropping of our deciduous tree leaves and shrubs. True fall when we start to see all the leaves dropping. But, yeah, there are so many pluses about gardening in fall. You know, and a lot of times you'll see little articles about, you should go buy your plants now because they're all on sale. And that's true, too. But unfortunately, for most of our garden centers, fall is not the time to get the best selection for perennials, trees, and shrubs. But it's a good time to shop because most places will have those plants marked down. And it's a great time to get them in the ground. But get them in the ground, get them watered. Make sure that you water them on a weekly basis until the ground freezes, so that's a lot longer than most people think.
Yeah. Patty Nagai, our guest today, she is now a horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls.
Yes.
And a retired horticulture educator with UW Extension. Great to have her with us. Gardening question? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News and Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Great to have back Patty Nagai, horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouses in Menominee Falls. And always, she and I have been doing talks together when she was with Extension for many a year.
Very long time.
Very long time.
Let's not talk about how long it's been.
Long enough. And I've learned that she knows a whole lot about gardening. And she can answer your questions. So give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, email us to talk@WPR.org. Matter of fact, Dawn in Marshall has a question for you, Patty. So
okay,
let's,
great.
Let's go there. Hi, Dawn.
Hi there. I have a raised bed with a bunch of beets, beet greens. They're very, very tiny, yet I guess I was reading up. They're sulking right now, not getting enough water. I realize that.
Mm-hmm.
I just put some fresh compost on them yesterday and going to feed them more with some organic fertilizer. My question is, am I going to get viable beets still this fall yet? If I keep them in the raised bed, cover them up in the, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Sure.
So there are a couple of things I would like to point out. And one is that you might be overdoing it a little bit with your organic matter. And because of that, you could get a flush of foliage growth. If you're trying to get beets, like the root, there are a couple of things you have to be careful about. One is that they are spaced properly, and you need at least, you know, they say an inch, but I think 2 inches.
2 inches is better.
You know, to really get good root development. If your beets are too close together, they will not form roots. You'll get great greens, and the greens are good. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But spacing is really important. Over-fertilizing is not necessarily good.
Not a good idea.
So,
especially
so be
nitrogen.
Careful. Yeah, be careful about that. Because typically in raised beds, if you've brought in a lot of organic matter like compost, typically the nutritive value of the soil is pretty high, so you might not need any additional fertilizer. And then secondly, beets are cold tolerant, and they will taste way better when they develop in cooler weather. And this is another one of those great things about fall gardening. There are a lot of vegetable crops that you could seed now. You could seed beets now and still get really good quality beets. You can seed carrots. You can seed a lot of different things that do okay in the cooler weather and will actually taste better once we get into those cool nights of fall. But beets will survive even a light frost. So I think we're a long ways away from a light frost. So you should be just fine.
Yeah, you're going to get some good beets.
Yeah, they'll taste better. It's, you know, when the days get shorter and the nights get cooler and you get a little bit of even that light frost on plants, that it alters their ratio of starch to sugar. And so things like beets and cabbage and carrots, they will just taste sweeter. You'll get a lot more flavor components. It's not just the sugar. The whole flavor profile changes when it gets cold.
So there you go, Dawn. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it.
See, she's fall gardening.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that. Thanks, Dawn. Well, Juliet in Hayward has a different kind of question, I think. Let's go there. Hi, Juliet.
Hi. I have 12 great big huge buckets in my yard, great big barrels, half barrels, and I have beautiful bleeding hearts that come up and fill my whole yard. They're beautiful.
Wow.
But I need to split them.
Okay.
Is this a good time to do it?
It is. Another great aspect of fall gardening is digging and dividing perennials. Things like bleeding heart that have already died back, definitely this would be the time to do it. You can still see where they are. You can remove that dead foliage. You can, you know, gently separate them and get them spread out, get them back in the ground. Make sure that you get them watered in really well, and they'll be fine. They will be happy as little bleeding hearts can be. Yeah. This is a great time to divide a lot of things. You know, iris, daylilies.
Now, is she gonna do them in? Are you gonna do those in barrels again, Juliet, or are you putting them in the ground, or what?
Yes. What's happened is that I have every year I bought a different type of bleeding heart and put them in these barrels.
Mm-hmm.
But I have barrels. I have deer here.
Oh.
Do they bother your bleeding heart? Well, not as much as anything else.
Yeah.
Everything else. So I've decided that since I'm doing best with the bleeding hearts, that if I split these and maybe protect them with some cages and some net to get them going, then when they get, it seems when they get a little bit bigger, the deer don't bother them as much.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I have not had any problems with my bleeding heart and deer.
But Juliet's in Hayward, and I was just thinking, yeah, if she's putting them back into tubs.
Yeah. But she says she's had them there, so they've obviously...
Yeah, so they are. Obviously, they've survived.
I think she's talking about pretty big,
yeah,
like
yeah,
whiskey barrel kind of, yeah, size, or beer barrel size.
Yeah, so they shouldn't freeze out over...
Massive soil.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, there you go, Juliet. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Mark in West Madison, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Larry. I have boxwood bushes, and the leaves are curling on them all over the bush. And I'm wondering what's going on and what do I need to fix that?
Mm. Are they yellowing also or just curling?
They're also yellowing a little bit.
Yeah.
Not really dark green.
You probably should have a sample taken into the disease diagnostic clinic and have Dr. Huddleston look at that. There's a boxwood blight disease that is now in our state. And I can't tell you, you know, over the radio what if you have it or not. But I would send a sample in or take it over to the... To the
extension.
Well, it's in. They're still in Russell.
Oh, Mark's
Russell
in
Labs.
West Madison, so you can take it right over.
Yeah, just take it right over to Russell Labs and drop it off for Brian Huddleston. There are instructions on his website for detailed instructions on how to take the sample and how to deliver it to the lab. But I would go ahead and have that taken in just to see what it is, because if it's boxwood blight, that's very serious.
Yeah, sorry if it's that.
Yeah,
for sure. But do that. It's the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. It's located on the Madison campus at Russell Laboratories.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure he's going to want maybe the whole disease leaves and then some that are partial.
Right.
There's different. He has a little different instructions.
He has some very good detailed instructions on how to package it up and deliver it and everything. And then, you know, if it turns out by some, it's sometimes strange things happen and it might be due to insect damage. If it turns out to be that, he just walks it over to PJ Leash and says, here, take a look at this. And they will get it figured out for you.
Yeah, and even the website is pretty easy. It's the letter P, PDDC. So like Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, PDDC.WISC.EDU.
Yep.
And that gets you right there.
Yeah, it's very Googleable too.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. It is. Mark, thank you.
Yeah, good luck.
Good luck. I hope it's not.
I hope it's not too.
Dot in Manitowoc, your turn. Hi, Dot.
Good morning. I'm going to experiment because the rabbits are eating my vegetables and my wonderful morning glories.
Mm-hmm.
So as I'm cleaning up my garden, I'm taking the stems from the rose bushes. Well, they have thorns, of course, and also the teasel stems. I'm going to cut them up in about 3 or 4 inch pieces, and I'm going to put them around my vegetables and particularly my morning glories. I'm so disappointed that the rabbits are eating them down to the ground each year. So that would be a very environmentally secure idea, because when the rabbits, I hope, travel over these thorns, they're going to say, ouch, 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 I'm not coming here anymore. And they'll leave them alone.
Okay. I'm not going to discourage you from trying that. And if it works, I would love for you to let us know that it works. I have been doing just honestly, just crazy things in my garden this year to try and keep not the rabbits, but the chipmunks and squirrels from eating all of my vegetables. So I'm all for trying natural things that, you know, they may discourage them. You just,
you
sometimes,
never know.
Sometimes people, I mean, I know, you know, repellents will work for a while and then they don't work anymore. So then you alternate repellents or you include blood meal or you can do a lot of different things with repellents.
You can put up a barrier, you know, the little rabbit fence works pretty well to keep out rabbits, but it doesn't affect deer or chipmunks or squirrels at all.
No.
I know of people who put down hardware cloth, which is the wire
screening
that apparently that doesn't feel good on their little feet either. And you can just
I didn't know that.
Lay it down on the ground, and sometimes that will discourage them. But honestly, this year, I just think these animals are super hungry. They are just eating everything. They are just horrible. They're just demolishing everybody's gardens this year.
But so, Doc, give that a try. I want to hear.
Yeah, I want to know if it works.
Definitely.
I'm not horribly optimistic, but I'm not opposed to it. Let's put it that way.
We're optimists. We're optimistic.
I know deer will eat rose bushes. Yeah. Rabbits will eat rose bushes in the winter. They will chew on them. So I'm not sure the thorns are, but you're right. The thorns on their little feet, that just sounds terrible. Like that would really discourage them.
It discouraged me. I was running around barefoot.
Absolutely.
Ran into some.
Right. Yeah.
Dot, good luck. Thank you.
Yes, good luck.
Thank you for calling. Kate in Freedom. We'll go to you now. Hi, Kate.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Yes, we've moved. We have a lawn, and I'd like to take part of that lawn and make it into a new garden,
mm-hmm.
a vegetable garden.
Mm-hmm.
And where do I begin and end?
There are so many different methods for doing this, and the method that is promoted through extension in the western half of the United States, and I'm not sure it's actually made it all this way, but I know it works, is to get arborist chips. So you can go to chipdrop.com, and they will, when they take down a tree, they'll bring you a load of chips. It's totally free. And you take those arborist chips and you lay them across. You first mow the grass down as low as possible. And then you come back with the arborist chips and you put them down at a depth of, are you ready for this? 12 inches.
Oh my goodness.
And so the arborist chips include a lot of leaf and twigs. So it's a very aerated mixture. So 12 inches shrinks down pretty fast.
Yeah.
And it will decompose fairly rapidly, but it takes at least 6 months to a year before you would be able to really plant in that area. The traditional way, of course, is to come in with a sod cutter and remove the sod and then have it tilled, which disrupts the soil structure, but it allows you to plant sooner. You know, get it all tilled up, bring in some organic matter, till that in so that you have a more friable soil that's a good consistency for root development of the tender vegetables. Another way to do it would be to come in and build raised beds. And then you would, again, scalp the lawn, bring it down to nothing, or take a sod cutter and remove it. Or spray it with a grass killer to kill all of the grass. But you don't disrupt the soil that way. Then you fill your raised beds with a mixture of compost and soil. And you can get that from a local soil supplier. Just make sure that it's clean, which is sometimes you don't know that until you get it and see the weed seeds coming up in it. But fill the beds with soil, and then you're ready to plant right away. So there are a lot of different ways that you can do it. It really depends on, you know, what resources you have available and how much energy you have to do them. They're all slightly different in the amount of time and the amount of energy that they take to get that soil prepared. I use a combination of things. I have a lot of raised beds that I established a long time ago that I do my vegetable gardening in. I also have straw bales that I garden in. I do a lot with large containers, and I have those containers in my vegetable garden, but I also have them in my herb garden, and I've got them in my flower beds wherever I have decent sun, I'm growing, you know, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, cucumbers, squash. So I garden, I grow vegetables in like every way possible.
and that's not a bad approach
no,
either.
No, I mean, well, when the chipmunks are eating the ones out in my raised beds, they a lot of times will leave the containers up close to the house alone. So then I get some tomatoes. It's sad.
Kate, thank you very much.
Good
for
luck.
Calling.
I think it's a great undertaking. I encourage people to do vegetable gardening, but I know how difficult it is to get started. So sometimes it's easier if you start small and do like a raised bed or a few containers and then work on getting that. Like the arborist chips works really well. It just takes longer to get to the point where you can plant.
But you could get some raised beds in there and have
absolutely
the arborist chips. And
yep, you could do a combination of things.
Yeah, for mm-hmm sure. Kate, good luck. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Jack in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Jack.
Yes, just calling in to say thank you to your guest. I was down, or my wife and I were down by your place in February or March seeking information on potting, using potting garden. And just to let you know, our cucumber and zucchini are doing excellent in the pot.
Great.
And they're over the trellis and back down onto the patio slab.
Okay. And so the vines are good, but are you also getting fruit off of them?
We're yellowing a little bit, and I don't know if that's due to the heat or
that's the heat.
We're trying to keep moist because of all the green on them.
Right, right. But you are getting fruit, right? You're getting cucumbers and zucchini.
Oh, yes, we are.
Excellent.
It's not overwhelming us, but we're getting enough to keep ourselves supplied.
That is perfect. That is perfect. Thank you so much for letting me know, and come back and see me again.
Jack, thank you very much for calling. Nice to get some kudos.
I love that. And I have to say, I've had a lot of people come into the greenhouse because they've heard me on Garden Talk.
Oh.
And so they come to the greenhouse to ask me their questions.
Well, I'm glad.
They may spend a couple dollars. Now people know where to find me.
Well, the Shady Lane Greenhouse, and I haven't been there yet.
You should come visit.
Just give a little description of the place, because it sounds fabulous.
It's a lovely family-owned greenhouse. We have about 4 acres. You know, we say 4 acres under glass, but of course it's not really glass anymore. It's, you know, polycarbonate and hoop houses and things. Family run. The owner is 88 years old. He's still very much involved in the business. His 2 kids, Heidi and Paul, are mostly running the day-to-day operations. We have the biggest G-scale model railway train permanent display in the Midwest. And it is amazing. And we have this wonderful group of garden railway volunteers that come in and bring their own personal trains. We can run like 18 trains at one time. It's so much fun. We have a big event coming up September 28th, our fall train jamboree, and we'll have lots of fun activities for the kids and live music and food,
man,
and games and lots of trains running, fancy trains. We're talking a serious, serious train hobby here. But we also grow beautiful plants. And so right now we have our mums, and we're just starting to space out our poinsettias. We've been growing our poinsettias since the 1st of July. So
Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls. Yeah. Not right in Menominee Falls, but
It's just on the outskirts.
Just
it's still
outskirts.
Menominee Falls, but it's right.
Yeah.
It's just off of Good Hope Road. Good Hope and Pilgrim. It's very easy to find, and it's a really fun place to visit. You should come visit. If you can't
come
on the fall train jamboree, then you should come at Christmas, because Christmas in the greenhouse is amazing.
Christmas might be the, you know, I've got my daughter's got cross country, and she's in college, and she runs cross country. But the 28th is what? Is that a Saturday?
It's a Saturday.
Yeah. Well, that might be a problem.
Okay.
I might be watching her run wherever it is she runs.
Well, that's important, so I'll let it pass this time.
But I'll think Christmas.
Christmas, you should come. Christmas, you know, we are fully decked out for Christmas by the middle of November. And lots of fun classes. We do all sorts of fun community things. So you should come. It's the most colorful Christmas greenhouse you will ever see.
Patty Nagai, our guest, horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls. You can join in. Number's 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, horticulturist Patty Nagai, and we are going right back to the phones and to Denise in Winona, Minnesota. Denise, hello.
Hello, hello. I've got a three question pack for you.
Okay.
My primary question has to do with my peonies. I had the most gorgeous peonies this year. Mm-hmm. I probably have about a strip of about 15 or 18 feet of them, and they were glorious. But over on the other side, I have two plants that seem to have been attacked by, I don't know what it is, because the leaves are all getting like gray, fuzzy. They're not fuzzy, but they gray mottled look to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What am I doing?
Powdery mildew.
It's powdery mildew. So that's a fungal disease that... there are a lot of different powdery mildew diseases. They tend to be pretty species specific. So the powdery mildew that you get on your peonies is not going to be the same one that gets on, for example, lilac or hollyhock or grass even. A lot of plants have succumbed to powdery mildew this year. It's been a great season for powdery mildew.
Yeah.
The high humidity, and we've had these hot temperatures, and we had a very early spring. You know, it's just been like the perfect mix of environment for powdery mildew. My peonies also have powdery mildew on them, and I'm not doing anything about it. I just am letting them do their thing, and then I eventually will cut them back, and they'll be fine next year. If you want to treat, you have to treat prior to the severity of the infection.
Too late for you, Denise.
once the leaves are gray like that, or the next stage will be brown, the powdery mildew will eventually kill the leaves, but it won't kill your plant, and that's the good news. To protect the other plants, or to protect it next year from getting powdery mildew, it tends to be in places that are maybe a little bit shadier, don't get as much air movement, maybe places where it's overcrowded. You can do a preventative type of fungicide application, but again, you have to do it before the disease really takes hold. So you have to look for that very first tiny little white spot that shows up. And most people just don't see that until it's too late.
So. And those two are on the end. Maybe that's the shady end of the...
Yeah, and it might be that they're more crowded. It could be that they're shadier.
Yeah.
There's a lot of reasons. They could be they're different varieties, and some varieties are more susceptible than others.
Yeah.
That's very true. There's so many variables. But the good news is it's not going to kill your plant. They will be fine next year. But if you do decide you want to try and do some preventative care next year, Brian Huddleston has a great fact sheet on powdery mildew at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, and it goes through some of the steps you can take to prevent it in the future.
Yeah.
But once they get to the gray stage, it's too late.
Too late.
Yeah.
Denise, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Glenn in Randolph, your turn. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. A number of years ago, I had a couple rows of carrots at the end of the season.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to pull them out, and I put about 10 or 12 inches of straw over the top.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pulling out, I think they actually grew during the wintertime in January, February.
Mm-hmm.
And they were so orange, and they were so good,
mm-hmm.
rather than try to put them up somewhere else.
Right, that's a really really fun garden technique to use, and I think that's great. But you have to be timely about it, because if you had waited maybe even another month before you pulled them out, they would maybe not be as tasty. So carrots are biennials, so they do live through the winter. They are very cold hardy, and they will definitely, even if you hadn't covered them with straw, but covering them with straw was a great idea, because then it would make it a little bit easier to get them out of the ground, because the ground freezes, of course, is really hard to to pull carrots.
Ice pick.
But that cold weather makes those carrots taste so much better. And you're right, they probably did continue to grow because the soil stays warm. In our area, and I forget where he's calling from.
Randolph.
It's a little colder up there.
Little.
But our ground doesn't typically freeze here in southeast Wisconsin up in December. You know, sometimes it doesn't freeze until the end of December. And so, and by covering them with straw, you prevented the ground, you know, from freezing. But they still were able to adapt to those cold temperatures. And that cold temperature is what causes the carbohydrates to switch from starch to sugar, so you got a little bit better tasting carrot, but you probably got a lot bigger carrot too. The same thing is true for you know, we talked about beets, and you could do the same thing with radishes, but radishes are a little bit more short season, so you have to be careful about not leaving them in too long. But carrots are biennials, so if you had let them go, and maybe you did let some of them go, they will send up new sprouts, they will flower. And then once they start that process, the root, the part that we eat, tastes terrible. It gets the texture of it changes from, you know, crisp and tender when you cook it to like stringy and woody. And they will lose some of their color, and believe me, they lose all of their flavor. It's just,
and all of their attractiveness.
Yes, so they are no longer carrots. They are now Queen Anne's lace. So you did it just perfectly. So kudos to you.
Good for you, Glenn. Thank you. Speaking of taste and some maybe bad taste here, Barb in Delavan emailed to say that her basil plants have produced bitter-tasting leaves, yet they have not bolted, and she wonders, how come?
Well, there are some newer varieties of basil. If she bought basil from me, she might have gotten one of the Everleaf types of basil. And there's three of them. There's a lemon, there's a Thai, there's a Genovese, and then there's an Italian. That's four types. So the Everleaf varieties of basil are really interesting because they get... they grow almost columnar, and they don't flower. Like, my basil still hasn't flowered, and here we're at the end of August, and you still don't have any flowers on it. But the taste is good. I have my basil planted in a somewhat semi-shaded area, and I make sure that it stays well watered. So bitterness sometimes can come from heat or drought stress, or in some cases it can be from overwatering. And we've had a lot of people with that issue too, because we've had so much rain. A lot of things have not fared well. So anything that can affect the overall health of the plant can definitely affect the taste. But it could be that you have one of those other varieties of basil. Sometimes when you buy basil, you don't know exactly what kind of basil you're getting.
Yeah.
You know? And there are, you know, hundreds of different types of basil. And some of them taste better than others.
Karen in Madison, your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So I created a flower garden at the end of my property, took the sod up, the whole thing, and I have a lot of perennials growing there now, and I had a section that had dahlias in it. And I took the bulbs out, and I didn't replant them, and now I have this huge thistle patch.
Ooh.
And I don't know. I even had an opportunity through one of my friends who had these black rubber mats that were pretty thick. I put those down in that area, and the thistles popped in between.
Yes.
So that's one question I have is I hate to use like Roundup or anything. Is there anything I can do to get rid of the thistles?
And do you know what kind of thistles they are? They're not Canada thistles, are they?
Are they super pokey?
They get really tall.
Oh.
Do they have a purple flower?
I think so.
Yeah. That's probably Canada
Leaf. Yeah,
that's hard. It's hard to get rid of them. Even, I'll be really honest, it's really hard to get rid of them even if you do use chemicals.
Yeah.
They are just so resistant to so much. And I have been on a pulling, digging the roots out campaign for thistles in parts of my garden area for years. And every time I think, oh, I got them all, I got them all. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, they're popping back up again. So I don't know that mine have bloomed in the last 15 years, but I probably still have seed. You know, if you let them go to seed, it's...
You're done.
It is a... It's a... It sounds terrible. I'm being so negative. I'm so sorry, but it's like a lifetime project trying to get rid of thistle. They just... They're so... They grow so well. They're just such a good growing plant, and they are so... They will take advantage of any bare area. And they're sneaky, too, because they'll also come up in the middle of all your other plants, and you won't see them until they are in flower.
Yeah.
And then by then, you know, they're like a
sunflower
plant. They're so huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you have any other advice? I mean, other than spraying with every chemical there is.
Yeah,
I will tell you that the vinegar,
that?
You know, you'll read online that you should use some strange combination of vinegar, salt, and Dawn. Everybody loses. They always say Dawn dish liquid. Don't do that. It's just bad. It's not good.
It's not good for your soil.
It's not good for your soil.
Salts, and you're not going to grow anything else.
Definitely not good for your other plants. But... you know, it also doesn't really work. So don't do that. But digging, pulling, and then when you get tired of doing that, invest in a total weed killer, one of those that will kill everything, and then very judiciously apply it just to the foliage of the thistle and not to anything else.
Yeah. There you go, Karen. Sorry, but thank you very much for calling.
I know. I feel sad that I'm not able to give her better advice than that. But.
Well, what about Veronica? She'd like to know when she can cut down her peonies. The leaves have brown spots.
It's a little early to cut peonies back unless they are totally decimated, like from powdery mildew or something. I like to leave the peonies standing until they are more than 50% brown. I only grow the Ito kinds of peonies, which is the hybrid with that has the woodier stems. And so I typically don't cut those back until October.
So. And speaking of cutting, Elaine wants to know, and Madison, should she cut down her irises before dividing them?
Whatever's easiest for her.
Yeah,
I will typically leave the foliage while I'm dividing them because it's a handle, you know, you can hold on to them. And then I cut them back and separate them out, clean them up, make sure you're looking for any signs of insect damage, get rid of those, and then replant, you know.
Yeah.
And then you can cut those fans back to, about an inch and a half.
Yeah,
and
makes sense.
Make sure they're clean, though, before you replant them.
Patty Nagai, our guest today, horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls. Our guest, and she'll be with us till 12:30, right up till 12:30 today. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us for Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my great guest, Patty Nagai, horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls and retired horticulture educator from UW Extension. We've been doing shows together for many years, and it's always great to have her back. questions for her, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And now that I've said that, I look and see all her lines are full. So let's go right back to John in Dodgeville. John, thank you for waiting.
Yeah. I'm calling about tomato plants. I had some kind of a brown leaf blight, which definitely affected the production of the plants this year. But I'm more concerned about what I can do to prevent it for next year.
Okay. There are so many different leaf blights that can affect tomato. It's a challenge, and this time of year we usually see all of them.
Yeah,
you know, there is the early blight, there's the septorial blight. If it were late blight, you wouldn't have anything left. So I'm assuming it's not that, because the late blight is very devastating. And then two other issues that I have seen this year on people's plants are whitefly and spider mite, which is interesting, but they also cause yellowing and browning of the leaves and leaf drop, and can definitely affect the production of the tomato, because of course if you lose your foliage, you know, your production is going to go down. So a couple of things to think about for next year, assuming that what you have is either septoria or early leaf blight, both of which Brian Huddleston has great fact sheets on at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. You can read those online or download them free. They're wonderful. They come from the soil. And so one of the things that we recommend is that you use some sort of mulch underneath your plants to prevent the soil from splashing up on those lower leaves. Once it gets established in the plant, it kind of works its way up. You can remove the infected leaves. You can make sure that you're watering carefully. Of course, this year we've had so much rain, you can't affect, you know, you can't stop the way the rain splashes down and then the soil splashes back up. So again, the mulch underneath is good. Proper aeration around your plants, making sure that you don't have your plants too crowded. It's so easy when you're planting your tomatoes in the spring to look and see that, oh, these are so small, I need to plant them closer so I can get more tomato plants in. But you're really defeating your purpose when you plant them too close, because if you plant them too close together, you're not going to get good production. And you'll have more disease issues. The remedy for this, if you do start to see spotting on the leaves, on the lower leaves, there are some organic approaches to preventing the spread of the disease. And again, when a fungal disease starts in your plant, it's, you can't really kill it, but you can prevent it from infecting the rest of the plant. So that requires some repeated spraying of some different products. There are some organic fungicides that contain things like sulfur and copper. There are some that contain neem oil, which has been shown to work against different types of fungal organisms. But those products, you have to follow the label instructions, obviously, but you have to repeatedly apply them to keep your plants. And so every time it rains, of course, the product is getting washed off and more soil is splashing up on your plants. So some of it is very weather dependent. You can also look for disease resistant varieties. And there are so many fabulous tomato varieties out there. These two leaf spot diseases are pretty common. So if you're growing heirlooms, they're all very susceptible. It's like, they're so delicious, but they are so susceptible to so many different diseases. So, you know, good maintenance, good planting techniques, maintenance, making sure you're removing diseased leaves, doing the preventative sprays, planting far enough apart so you have good air movement, all of those things will help.
Let's take it back to a couple of springs ago when I was on my neighborhood jog through the neighborhood, and there was a guy out putting his got plants in a little, about a 6x6 area, and he was planting his tomatoes
like a foot apart. Yeah, and well, they're so small, Larry. They're plenty of room. Yeah,
and until they grow. So I stopped and talked to him about it, and I said, you know, you should probably take out about half of those plants. Take out every other one. You're going to have a lot better. And he said, my wife told me to plant these plants in this spot. he was just following all of them regardless.
Yeah.
No. And I later, in, so I kept a little watch, and sure enough, there were the typical issues you just discussed.
Well, the air movement and having, you know, decent spaces, it really affects not just disease problems, but it affects production as well. If you plant things too close together, there's so much competition for nutrients and water and sunlight that you're going to not get very good production. And proper pruning, you know, we don't talk a lot about pruning tomatoes, but different types of tomatoes require different types of pruning. And, you know, when we get towards the end of the summer, pruning, you know, you could prune your plants back because our fruit production season is coming to an end.
Yeah.
So if you've got vines that have no flowers or fruit on them or just starting to flower and they look like they're crowding out the rest of your plant,
get rid of them.
You could probably get rid of those. You don't need a tomato vine that's 20 feet tall either.
No.
That's hard to pick the tomatoes.
Linda in Oshkosh. We'll go to you now. Hi, Linda.
Hello. And I have a question about salvia. Mm-hmm. I bought some annual salvia.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told that you could dig them up and bring them in to winter over.
Mm. Do you want to do that?
Do you have any experiences? Well, this salvia was, I actually was at the Garden Expo and I went to a lecture about hummingbirds, which started this whole thing. And so I have some really drop-dead gorgeous blue salvia that I would like to keep if I could.
Mm.
So I don't know if you're interested in that. Or the other part of that, can you save seeds?
For some of them, yes, you can save seeds. But most of the ones that are grown today are hybrids. And so the seed may or may not give you the type of salvia that you like. I will tell you, because I work at a garden center, you know, a greenhouse, I will say you should just come buy new ones in the spring. But also the gardener in me knows where you're coming from. And I have overwintered all kinds of crazy things. It is possible, but these are the things to be careful about. First of all, you're going to have to cut it way back. You will have to maintain it like a houseplant. You cannot let it go dormant. You can cut it back. You can continue to water and fertilize it over the winter, but you're going to have to keep it somewhat smaller. Then you are going to have to inspect it very carefully because you do not want to bring crazy insects into your house. So you need to make sure it's really clean before you bring it into your house. It needs as much light as you can possibly give it. So in addition to putting it by a bright window, you will need to invest in a plant light so that it can have some additional. Otherwise, you're going to be very disappointed because it's just going to drop all its leaves and it knows it's fall. It's going to curl up in and die, and then you'll be sad.
So, there you go, Linda.
But you know, if you really want to save it, I would say go ahead and give it a good try, but you don't follow my instructions and get a nice light because it's going to need some additional light.
Linda, there you go. John in Middleton, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. My concern is with Joseph's coat, which we unfortunately planted as a ground cover in between the other plants in a bed, and it has just simply taken over everything, and I would love to get rid of it.
Oh, isn't it pretty, though?
Oh, it's pretty, but I would like to see some of my other plants, but it just flat overgrows everything.
It does, yes.
And is there a way to eliminate that without either blasting it with chemicals or just digging up the dirt and putting new dirt in? Or what options do I have here?
Well, you've just given yourself all of the options.
Yeah.
I have the same issue at my house. I actually shared some of mine with my neighbors, and they like it. But we have a kind of a naturalized area where there are other things that will compete with it, so it does really well, like on the edge of a woodland, you know, that shadier kind of situation. And so in that part of my yard, I just let it go. But when it starts popping up in my vegetable garden, which it does, I just pull it. I pull it all the time. I'm pulling it right along with the thistle. I'm pulling that stuff. So yeah, you can pull it. Try not to let it go to seed. So, you know, if you've got some that it's flowering, you can go out there and at least cut those flowers off so you don't get more seed production. You can do the hand painting method with a weed killer to try and get it to die back. But actually, it pulls pretty easily.
Yeah.
It's just a constant. It's one of those constants. You just have to keep after it.
It's a good year for pulling weeds, by the way, with all the rain.
Well, all the rain has made it nice and soft and pretty easy to pull.
Yeah, did a lot of that this year.
Yeah. You know, honestly, I don't have as much trouble with the Joseph coat now as I did a few years ago, so I'm thinking that my pulling has actually worked. It has not worked with the thistle. I don't
know.
Thistle is still my nemesis.
Bane.
But that one, yeah, you can pull it. And if you've got a big swath of it that you'd like to get rid of and you don't want to pull or dig, then you're going to have to use a weed killer.
Yeah. John, good luck. Thank you. Andreas in West Salem, we go to you now. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, it's hello, Larry. Big fan. And I've learned so much with you guys. So thank you very much for your Fridays especially, but all the week. Anyway, I've got, and I apologize, I forgot if it was called a white dust or white mold that everyone's been getting on their leaves.
Powdery mildew.
Powdery mildew.
I'm sorry, powdery mildew. I was curious, I'm kind of an organic gardener, or I just don't spend any money on the chemicals, so I guess it's organic. You know, I've got a pony, so I use pony poop mostly as my fertilizer. But I was curious, I've got a compost pile. Could I put those dead leaves in my compost pile, or am I going to get, is that a bad idea?
I think that's not a good idea. Although, to be honest, powdery mildew is everywhere. It's one of those opportunistic kinds of diseases. The spores are everywhere. And if the conditions are right for powdery mildew and the plant is a susceptible plant, you're going to get powdery mildew. So the science person in me is saying, oh, you should probably bag that up and get it out of there because you don't want to add to the powdery mildew problem. But the practical gardener side of me is saying it's not going to matter because, you know, by the time it's composted.
Yeah, it takes a while. I mean, if you bagged it up, you could just leave it in the bag for.
That's true. You could bake it off.
Bake it.
Yeah. I don't know how long. That's a good question for Dr. Huddleston is, you know, how long do those spores hang around? And is it possible that, you know, if the plant material is totally dead, are the spores even still active?
Yeah.
I don't know. I have lots of questions about that, actually.
Well, if you, I guess the you can probably try it, or if you want, you could just bag them up and let them sit for a year and then use them. Yeah. I'm pretty sure you wouldn't have any trouble after that time.
No, I don't think you would either, and I'm not sure how big of an issue it is. I mean, normally, I know that Brian Huddleston, he in general recommends across the board that if you've got diseased plant material, you really shouldn't put it in your compost.
Yeah, yeah.
And most home compost does not get up to a high enough temperature to kill off various diseases. So that's good practice.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We have some emails. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with a call, but let's do some emails here. Kim wonders when she can move her black-eyed Susans and will they be okay in partial shade?
Oh, absolutely. Rudbeckia can handle some shade. They can handle like the east side of a house where they only get a few hours of morning sun. They can handle. They do need some sun. They don't. They will grow in shade. Let's be really certain about that. They will grow in shade, but you might not get very good flowering on them, and you will have more issues with septoria leaf spot. You'll have more issues with diseases in a moist shade kind of situation. But they could be dug and divided right now. You can put them in a part shade area. Make sure that you are spacing them appropriately. So disease is one of the biggest issues with Rudbeckias. They are so susceptible to leaf spot that they need good air movement.
Nancy in Appleton emailed. She has leftover native plant seeds and mm-hmm. is considering scattering in a woodland area cleared of invasive plants.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be best to scatter seed in early fall or wait until winter if they are seeds that need cold stratification?
Hmm.
She has some leftover seeds that are still in the refrigerator that were cold stratified in spring.
Oh.
Would these stratified seeds held in the refrigerator still be viable?
Wow. I think that is a species specific kind of a question.
You're right.
But in general, if you think about when the plant naturally drops its seed,
mm-hmm.
that is the ideal time to put the seed in the ground.
Yeah.
You know, for things that produce seed in the spring, when we're talking about native plant cultivation, that's when the seed goes into the ground. And so that would be the perfect time. My inclination would be to plant those or to scatter those seeds now. And go ahead and get them in the ground. If they're already stratified, they may start to germinate, but we still have several months of warm soil. They might be able to develop a pretty decent root system if they germinate now. The ones that are not stratified obviously will lay in that soil, and they will be just fine until next spring.
But you don't want them laying in the weeds or in the leaves. Wouldn't you clear that area a little
Ideally, you would want to have good soil seed
contact.
Take
a rake with you mm-hmm. when you do it.
Yeah.
Linda in Madison emailed, she'd like to remove a patch of winter creeper vine surrounding a tree stump in her mm-hmm. yard. She's been pulling up the spreading vines every year and would mm-hmm. like to do more to discourage it. The creeper has a few woody trunks about 3 inches in diameter.
Oh, my.
What herbicide would kill these, and what time of the year is best to apply it?
Fall is the best time, and you need to cut back to the trunk. And I think it's probably a good time to apply that brush killer triclopyr, the Garlon type. I don't think you can get glyphosate anymore. I think glyphosate is pretty much off the market for retail for homeowners. You can still get it professionally, but glyphosate would work too if you had somebody who could get you the professional strength glyphosate. What they sell as Roundup now is not glyphosate. It's
something else.
It's Diquat. It's Diquat mixed with some other. It's nasty stuff. But the Garlon, the triclopyr, should take care of it. Look for a product that says it's a brush killer.
Mm-hmm.
And then the best time to do it is in the fall when the temperatures are starting to cool off. And make a cut and apply the product within 30 minutes directly to the cut. And you might have to do it more than once, but that'll take care of it.
Bill in Fitchburg emailed in 2023, he saved and mulched with leaf litter and avoided needing to buy 8 yards of shredded bark. However, the leaves broke down by mid-July, leaving mm-hmm. him denuded soil in many areas. So what compost can Bill add late summer before fall leaves are available? Shredded bark would take too long to break down and would not mix well with the leaves. Also, he has a very sandy soil, so organic matter disappears quickly.
Wow.
Any advantage in working compost into the upper soil in the fall? It's another.
I think in sandy soils like that, and actually with most garden areas that are low in organic matter, you can add compost at any point. Compost can be added, you know, when you're planting, it can be added as a mulch. It can be incorporated into the soil. You know, it can be added at any time. So if he's got a good source for some nice, clean, well-composted compost, he could put that down now, and that would work really well with his leaves. Otherwise, if he wants to do the more long-term approach, he can do the arborist chips, and you can get those delivered to your house free. Mm-hmm. If you go to chipdrop.com, they will...
They will bring you a huge load of, but it's not just, it's like the whole tree. So yeah. It's leaves and branches and wood and bark and it's
all
everything.
All chopped up.
All chopped up. And I'm amazed at how fast it degrades, actually. It actually works pretty well.
Somebody's going to say, wait a minute, what was that website again?
Chipdrop.com.
Chipdrop.com. There we go. We said it three times.
You can just Google Chipdrop and it'll pop up. The arborists are really, at least the ones that I've dealt with, they've been really good about it. It's clean. It is, yeah. You know, it's usually like one species of tree too. So it's just like a tree in your driveway. Yeah.
As long as it's not a black walnut.
There
you go.
Yeah, I use it for pathways in my vegetable garden between my raised beds, and I've never had any issues with it at all.
Laura emailed, she started a yellow peony Bart in a pot, and it wintered in her garage last year, and she's wondering when to transplant it into the flower garden.
Ooh, now.
Now would be the good time.
Now would be good. Yeah, absolutely. Those peonies, you know, and peonies are picky about how they're planted, so be careful. So even those hybrid, those interspecific hybrid peonies like Bartzella and those types, don't plant it too deeply. You know, make sure that crown is right at the soil level, so you don't want to disturb that whole flowering process. And then... as any perennial or shrub planting, you know, this time of year up until the time that the ground freezes, I do recommend mulching. So watering weekly and a good layer of organic mulch to make sure that soil stays protected.
And with those plants, you know, you're putting some in, that watering right up to until freeze is pretty important, especially for pine type.
Right. It's very important for anything that has evergreen characteristics. And that could be a boxwood, a broadleaf evergreen, or it could be something, you know, like a pine tree or a spruce or any of those types of evergreens. Arborvitae are very sensitive to overwintering in dry soil. So you have to remember that anything that has leaves during the winter, whether it's a conifer or a broadleaf plant, if it maintains its leaves over the winter, it needs water in the soil up until the time the ground freezes.
On that happy note, Patty, thank you so much.
You are very welcome.
And we will have you back again, and we'll do this all over again.
I would love to come back again. I always have a great time.
Patty Nagai, our guest horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls. Pay her a visit sometime. You'll enjoy talking with her in person, and you'll enjoy your time at the greenhouse. Coming up, we're going to talk about emerald ash borer and some other tree problems. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take some minutes to talk with you about the emerald ash borer. It's been in Wisconsin since I think it was 2008. And since then, we've had millions of dollars spent for tree removal and replacement. And we want to talk about some of the latest efforts to combat this invasive insect. And our guest to do it, Paul Segan, a DNR forest health specialist, works out of Hayward and has an update for us. And as we talk with Paul, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about the emerald ash borer? Maybe there's some other issues. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Paul, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Larry. Thanks again.
You were with us in May, and you predicted that soon the emerald ash borer would be in every county of Wisconsin. And has that happened? Give us an update.
Yes. Yes. We spoke back in early June at Bayfield and Bloom, and the prediction has come to fruition this year, Larry. We now have EAB detection in all 72 of Wisconsin counties. And the reason I thought we'd reach that threshold is because we did have quite a bit of an uptick in the last 2 years in county level detections. We probably added 5 to 7 counties in the last couple of years. So it's really increased as to the rate of new county detections. And it's likely that EAB was in all 72 of our counties prior to this year, simply because it tends to arrive and infest an area much sooner, several years, maybe 5 years typically, before we start to see symptoms and it reaches a detection threshold. So big year in EAB news this year. We've got that milestone, the all 72 counties, but we've also had EAB in Wisconsin now for about 20 years. I know technically we've got the 2008 year noted as the first EAB detection down in the southeast, Ozaukee and Washington counties. But looking at some dendrochronology and tree ring analysis suggests it probably was here since 2004. We just had missed it because of that difficulty in detecting it. So probably around the 20-year anniversary it took to get across this entire state here.
No,
so,
man.
Yeah, it's big news.
Well, maybe probably worth it to explain what the invasive insect does to ash trees.
Yeah, so this is a type of insect that we call a wood borer, and it kills a tree when the adults lay eggs onto typically the outer branches of the upper portions of an ash tree. All of our native ash trees are susceptible, the green, black, and white ash. We also have a fourth species in Wisconsin, a much smaller component of the overall forest called blue ash. It shows some resistance to EAB. But in any event, these adult females will lay their eggs on the upper portions of the branches. Initially, those eggs hatch into small, what we call larvae. They're little worm-like creatures that bore into the stem, the twig, and they start to feed underneath the bark on the phloem. And what that does is it causes disruption in the water flow and nutrient movement in the tree. And over the course of anywhere from 2 to 5 years, the tree ends up dying from this dysfunction caused in its conductive tissue. And usually the young larva will regenerate into an adult in about a year's time. Sometimes it takes 2 years, depending on the location, north or south in the state, and depending on the local weather in a given year, a couple of years. But generally, we see a one-year life cycle from egg to adult in most of Wisconsin. Mm. And that leads to pretty quick mortality when EAB starts to get into one of these ash stands.
Oh, man. The tree's not going to live very long.
No, typically what we see is within 2 to 5 years, the tree will be killed by EAB. And it depends on a few factors. We do see a little bit of variability in the species of ash as to how soon they're killed after initial infestation, whereby our white ashes are a little bit slower to die. Green ashes are very quick to die. It is probably more like a 3-year turnover from an introduction to mortality. And then our black ashes is quite quick. It can be 2 years. And it sort of depends on how high the EAB population is in an area. Initially, when the insect arrives into a new area, whether it is introduced by firewood movement or log movement by us, it will take longer. It will take maybe 5 years before it kills an individual tree. But once that population establishes and we're like 5 years into the introduction out of sight, the population of EAB is much higher and more of them will attack an individual tree and we'll start to see that death rate increase quite quickly. And that's where we get down to maybe 2 years in some cases to take out an entire, could be a very large tree, a 30-inch diameter type of tree will die in just about 2 years.
Yeah. Can I kind of always tell which trees are ash trees anymore around here when everybody else's, all the other trees are leafing out well, you can pick those ash trees out. because they're not.
Chris, yeah, you can, and that's a good point, Larry. Getting into those symptoms, what you would expect to see to recognize trees as being killed by EAB or having symptoms of EAB infestation. And typically, what we talk about are when we see canopy or crown thinning, leaves of an ash tree that look a little bit stunted in size, a little smaller. The crown looks a little bit more diffuse. You can see through it a little bit better. Also, sometimes a little bit of lime greenness to the leaves, a little bit of discoloration and lighter green color. And then, of course, the branch dieback, where we're starting to miss leaves in the outer foot to several feet of those upper branches. That's often indicative that we've got some EAB infestations. There's some other things that can cause that dieback, but EAB is a fairly reliable fairly reliable guess if you're seeing that. And of course, we see a lot of woodpecker activity after a couple of years of a tree being infested. The woodpeckers will start to try to forage, feed for those larvae underneath the bark and peck away the bark, leaving kind of a lighter color to the bark. We call it blonding. And then some of these epicormic sprouts can start to develop off of the main stem. They usually, these spindly sprouts that come off the main stem and then eventually cracks in the bark. And if you're lucky enough, you get maybe the gold standard of signs of the pest in the tree, and that's the D-shaped exit hole. That we usually don't see until the very kind of final year that the tree's alive, but it's going to have that D-shaped exit hole where the adult beetle has developed underneath the bark, and it then exits the tree and leaves behind that kind of signature shape of its head, which is kind of a D-shaped. So those are kind of what we would look for down in the southeast and some parts of even middle of Wisconsin in the central sands. The amount of mortality is just staggering. It's where you see an ash forest, you just see dead crowns of trees, completely lifeless among what is often an understory of green vegetation underneath it, but these old relics and skeletons of trees. It's really quite sad.
It is. Christina in Glenwood City has a question, I believe, relating to ash. Let's go there. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. I live in St. Croix County. I have beautiful ash trees that follow the curve of my driveway, and I trim them in the winter. However, we do have some limbs that are long and interfering with mowing. Should I wait to trim those, or is it safe to do so now?
I would generally wait to trim. With all trees, whether it's a pine or it's a deciduous tree, you're going to get usually a little bit better response if you wait until the dormant period to do pruning. If it's a deciduous tree, you're going to see better how to prune the branch as far as the structure goes. You won't have all the leaves to contend with. So you can kind of target and see where to prune easier. And then the other thing is there's just not as many pests or diseases that can be problematic and invade those wound sites created when you prune. So waiting until the first couple of frosts is a safer bet. What I would say, though, too, if you're going to be investing in your ash tree, whether it's just some sweat equity at the homeowner level that you're going to do with your ash, or hire an arborist to do some thinning or pruning of the ash, is to really think about whether or not you want to save the ash and use some protective insecticides. It won't generally make a whole lot of sense right now to invest much effort into an ash tree unless it's going to be protected with insecticides, simply because it's going to end up getting killed most likely anyway. And so I would make that first determination. Is this a tree I really want to keep around? And if it is, look at some of the insecticide options and then invest in some of your time and effort or get some professional assistance with pruning.
Yeah, that whole business with the insecticides, those are injected into the soil, or how do they work? What are the treatments?
Yeah.
Maybe we should just talk about treatments in general for this, but...
Yeah, this is a really important component of EAB management, both in the municipal areas, urban types of areas, but also people who live in much of Wisconsin's rural area who might have a very nice yard ash tree that they want to protect. And the first thing to really think about is, does the tree meet kind of the criteria that would cause you to want to invest in it? Does it have a good shape? Is it located in the yard where it provides some nice shade? Does it mitigate some of the potential stormwater effects? Most trees would. So asking yourself those questions and then thinking about the financials involved in it too. if you have a tree that's an ash tree that's under 15 inches in diameter, there are some really good homeowner-based products that can be used to protect ash trees. These homeowner products are typically what's called drenches that are mixed with water at rates listed on the label, poured onto the soil at usually during the growing season, typically May through September. They'll then percolate into the root zone and be taken up through the roots by the tree and provide that kind of systemic protection in the tree. So the tree kind of indirectly receives the herbicide or the insecticide while you sort of fertilize it on the ground. If trees are bigger than 15 inches in diameter, or folks want to get longer time periods of protection, say 2 to 3 years, it's usually recommended to go with an arborist-based type of product. And a really good one that we recommend we know is very effective is emamectin benzoate. That's the chemical name of a product that provides between 2 to 3 years of protection. The difference in this, though, this is not a soil drench that you'd mix with water and pour around the base of the tree. This is injected with a set of tubes that go into the tree at various points around the root flare and are taken up by the tree system over the course of an hour to several hours, and they're generally done by an arborist. A little bit more expensive treatment, but provides a longer-term type of protection. When we're getting to that 15-inch diameter range, trees that big really probably need to have that arborist-grade injection just so that you get adequate coverage throughout so much of that tissue of the tree.
It's probably going to vary a little bit in terms of the cost for that emamectin benzoate, but application of that... What's the price range for something like that? And we're talking every 3 years, probably.
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's going to vary based on the market someone's in for their arborist. But I guess recently I talked to an arborist in my area in Northwest Wisconsin doing injections, and I think it was about $15 per diameter inch. So if you multiply that out, $15 diameter inch, you can kind of figure what that cost is going to be. And that's just a crude estimate. A homeowner product for, say, a tree that's 10 inches using one of those kind of annual-based treatments you have to treat every year, that's going to be around that $25 to probably $35 mark based on recent data. So, yeah, definitely going to be more expensive. But then you have to factor, you're going to get probably just a little bit better protection with the arborist treatment, and you're not going to have to do it as often.
Yeah, so if you're looking at, 15 inches, that's in the neighborhood of $200 or a little over $200, I guess. So maybe figuring you're spending $70 a year or so to protect that tree, which, you know, certainly if I had a nice ash tree, I'd be willing to spend $70 a year on average to keep it there.
Yeah, and there's a couple other things, too, there to think about, Larry, is that, well, if you don't treat, of course, the tree is eventually going to get killed. Yeah. Could be a matter of a year or two, or it could be 5 years, but it's not going to be that long. This pest is so effective. And so then you have to balance the removal and replanting costs up against the treatment costs. So that's another factor. And removals are quite expensive. Oftentimes, if the tree is, say, 15 inches in diameter, that could be $1,000 removal, roughly, depending on the market. But yeah, it's very expensive. So I think about that too.
Paul Segan, our guest, DNR Forest Health Specialist, he's working out of Hayward. We're talking with him about emerald ash borer right now, and I think he could take some other tree-related questions as well. And you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Talking with Paul Segan today, DNR Forest Health Specialist, works out of Hayward. Great to have him back to talk about emerald ash borer, and we can take some other tree-related questions as well with him. So great to have him along. Is there any good news on stopping emerald ash borer? I mean, all right, we can do the emamectin benzoate, but is there there any way we can get rid of the borer?
Yeah, that is the million-dollar question, Larry. And it turns out there is some bright spots when we look at the overall integrated pest management with a pest like EAB. Now, let's back up for a second and think about this. EAB got here roughly 2004, spread across all 72 counties in just that 20-year time frame. And now most of the county south of, say, Highway 29 have substantial amount of mortality and dieback. And so this really has been the most impactful and significant tree killing pest that most of us have seen in our career, and frankly, in the history of the U.S. In recent times. So it's really dramatic. But the good news is that we are seeing a lot of these young ash down in the southeast in particular start to reach seed-bearing age now, and they are producing a second set, not second set, but a production of seed, and the seed is growing into a new cohort of trees. So we have that. So we have some natural reproduction on the landscape. Secondly, we have been introducing non-stinging parasitoid wasps here in the state for the last roughly 10 years, about three different species. And these have a good impact on reducing the EAB population carrying capacity once the initial wave of mortality has gone through. And so the hope is that once we've reached in all counties this kind of post-EAB mortality wave where most of the ash have been killed and the pest really declines in population, we will have enough of these biocontrol wasps that sort of track onto the population and keep EAB's population at a much lower level, allowing some of that ash regeneration to continue to reach seed-bearing age and produce seed to keep and perpetuate ash on the landscape. Meanwhile, we are doing some things to look at just how can we sort of really be proactive with getting some resistant phenotypes of ash on the landscape. And so what we're doing right now at the DNR is using satellite imagery to identify areas that have long been impacted by EAB, like down in the southeast, and look for these rare individuals of ash that have survived the initial wave of mortality and are still living. We call these lingering ash. These trees might hold the key to some of the resistance genes that is naturally occurring within the various ash species populations. If we can find these individuals, these lingering ash, and collect their seed, we have a secondary program that's looking at collecting that seed and testing it against EAB by introducing seed of EAB onto these growing trials of seedlings and seeing if they're attacked by EAB, and then selecting the most resistant phenotypes of that trial and breeding them together to eventually get at a fairly hardy phenotype of the various ash species that can cope with EAB or for some reason is less attractive to EAB. Now, this is many years out, and this takes a lot of time to put together and test and validate, but this is one of the hopes that in the long run, say the next 20 years, we can start to identify a group of these resistant phenotypes and potentially introduce them both on the landscape in a more kind of forestry operational setting, but also then make them available for commercial applications and retail nurseries and such. So that's a big part of this is looking into the future, recognizing that ash is so important on the landscape. It comprises roughly 8% of the forest trees we have, 20% of the trees we have in the urban environment, and that there's a big void to fill. And if we can promote that by doing some of these proactive approaches, that would really be helpful.
Jim in Appleton, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I wanted to just mention our experience with having trees treated. We've got three ash trees that we planted 37 years ago when we built a house, and they're roughly 60 feet tall, I'm guessing. My mother-in-law gave us the money for the trees, so there's great emotional attachment to them. When we started about 6 or 7 years ago having them treated, Appleton has been decimated by the ash borer, and we just had a contractor come in, and I think they removed 1,400 trees from the boulevard. And these trees have remained healthy. And so it's roughly $1,000 every 2 years, a little bit more than that, to have them treated. So it's roughly $11 a week to have those trees in the backyard. And I think that's cheap money. So I would strongly encourage that if you have healthy trees to start, that you continue to have them treated.
Jim, thank you so much for calling. I'm glad to know your trees are there. Paul?
Yeah, no, that's a good point, Jim. Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, Jim sounds like an advocate and a believer in using the insecticide treatment. And I think that makes a lot of sense. Again, buffering up against the removal costs. And the other thing with this whole EAB post-mortality population size is that once the EAB is largely moved through an area, the expectation is that these retreatments, this isn't known for sure yet, and this is going to depend on the local situation of EAB pest pressure in an area, but once it's moved through an area, the retreatment cycles could potentially be pushed out to not every 2 or 3 years, but potentially 4, 5, or 6 years, because there's just so much, many fewer EAB in that area, and thus the tree may not need such high levels and high doses of protection to make it through the EAB pressure. So there is that too. We might be able to get to an area in time where we don't have to retreat so often, and we can still keep those trees healthy.
Margo in Hancock has a different kind of question. Hi, Margo.
Hi. I am wondering if you could discuss oak wilt. I live in central Wisconsin. Our soil is very sandy, and we're a pine area, but we do have oak. I've got a massive oak tree in my backyard, and I just noticed that the crown has some dead branches on it. I really don't have other oak trees surrounding this one, but I know a lot of folks in my area have lost whole sections of trees due to oak wilt.
Yeah, Margo, thanks for the question. It's that time of the year where my phone pretty much rings off the hook with oak wilt questions, because it's at this time of the year when the symptoms are showing most prominently. And what we tend to see with oak wilt is rapid loss of leaves. Now, you mentioned your oak has, you know, a couple of dead branches. It could be oak wilt, but generally what we're seeing, if we're seeing oak wilt in that tree, is we're seeing the leaves fall from the tree within a matter of 3 to 6 weeks very quickly. The leaves starting to drop off. And it's not just in one or a couple of the branches, it's across the whole crown. When we see that, we're really thinking about oak wilt if it's happening during this time of year. So what I would recommend is to probably have one of the local arborists take a look at the tree and see if they might be able to provide you a diagnosis. The other thing you could do if you want to do it on your own is to go onto the Wisconsin DNR's website and go to the Forest Health page and look at our fact sheets about oak wilt. We've got a couple of different fact sheets, one on the disease, biology, and symptoms, as well as one on management. Take a look at some of those pictures and see if what you're seeing in your tree resembles some of those images and descriptions on those fact sheets. And if you think it does, it may pay to contact an arborist quite quickly to see what your options are. Generally, when it starts to infect a red oak tree, like I'm guessing you have a red oak, there's really no way of saving it. The fungus moves so quickly through the vascular system and kills trees at a rate that's just not really we can't really react quickly enough with any kind of fungicide treatment. But if you have other oaks in the area, that's where we want to find it and identify it quickly to potentially prevent it from spreading outward to yet other oaks in that site.
Yeah. Rick in De Pere emailed, has two dying ash trees in the backyard due to EAB. If he cuts them down, can he keep the wood for firewood, or does he need to get rid of the wood?
No, we had a state quarantine for a while, Larry, and that dictated a little bit about how firewood and other types of wood transport was required. But that quarantine was lifted around 2020. 2022. And so at this point, no, there's no restriction in keeping that wood on your property. If it is going to be moved, recommend contacting the local municipality to determine if there's any restrictions on disposal sites where they recommend wood be brought based on the municipality's requirements or policies, if they have any. But local use is really the best option. Although EAB is now in all counties, it's best to try to keep wood local so we don't promote any further advancement there.
Well, I tell you what, we have lots of questions here, Paul, that we haven't covered, and I'm sorry we can't get to them, but I thank you so much, and hopefully we can get you back more quickly and get you on to talk about those other tree diseases as well. Paul Segan, DNR Forest Health Specialist, works out of Hayward. We'll get him back as quickly as we can to talk some more about trees. Always great to have you listening in, and a big thanks to Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our producers, technical director Jeff Robbins and Lee Rayburn, and our executive director, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots in store here on WPR News.